Leaders are all around us at all times and in every area of our lives. In this special episode of our Central Texas Leadership Series, an exclusive interview with Chris Boyd, host and managing editor for the midday talk show Think, who visited Waco for KWBU President's Circle and Cornerstone Society events. This program was recorded October 26, 2018, in the KWBU studio. Hosting the conversation is Carl Hoover, entertainment editor for the Waco Tribune Herald.
Thank you so much for having me, Carl. It's a pleasure to be here.
I was wondering if naming a program Think shapes everything behind that. Does that give you a angle to hang what you want to do, and how does it guide what you do in that program?
I think it does. Think is really a show about ideas, and so my most favorite questions are the why questions and the what if questions. And I'm always excited to encounter material that is new to me. So rather than redoing the facts in the news that are happening elsewhere, we look at Think as an opportunity to gain some perspective by looking at the world through the lens of history and art and science and culture and lots of other ways that are not necessarily reflected in daily news. And so we want to give you – we don't ever want to tell you what to think, but we want to give you things to think about.
Tell me what goes behind a typical program. There's a lot of intensive work that you and the production staff do. What's going on behind the scenes that informs what people hear in their ears?
We talk before we choose any guest for the show or any topic for the show. We have a pretty small staff. Currently, we are at three, but we normally have four, and we're replacing someone. And we talk about whether something feels like it would be a good fit for the show, whether it feels like it's a unique perspective on something, whether it offers a way of looking at the world that maybe isn't always talked about. And then it really just is about preparation. So my producer and associate producer are making the calls and making sure that there is studio space for our guests to be in, because sometimes they're in the room with me, but very often they are in a radio studio of some kind halfway across the country or even in another country. So they're working on those details and getting everybody where they need to be. And I'm working on the content. So I'm reading background materials on the guest. If they've written a book, I want to read that. I want to read, about people who have approved of their work and praised their work, and also people who've criticized their work. And I just want to know as much as I can about the thing that we're going to talk about so that I can ask questions that really connect my guest with my audience.
Understand you read as many as 5 to 8 books in a week?
That is true.
Yeah. How do you do something like that?
Very quickly. I have ways of getting through material that I don't necessarily recommend to people. People always say, how do you read so quickly and how can I do that? I would not read this way if I had all the time in the world. So with a nonfiction book, you can pay really close attention to the introductory chapter. You know, a lot of people skip the introduction and they go straight to page one of chapter one. And in a nonfiction book, the author has told you everything that he or she thinks is important that's to come in that book. So having read the introduction, I can really look for that as I'm going rather quickly through the book. I always read, if there's an epilogue or a conclusion chapter, I always read that. And I always make sure to look very carefully at the index in the back. And if there are things that I don't recognize, I realize I need to look a little more carefully back through the book. And then as I'm reading, there are these little tabs that you can get at Dollar Tree. You get 500 for a dollar, and I will put a couple hundred of those into a book and mark up the places that I want to be able to find again when I'm writing questions for a particular interview. If something catches my attention or if I just don't fully understand it or I need to look it up, I'll have a tab there.
I saw a picture of one of your books that you had tabbed, mm-hmm. and it's like 20 tabs or more. I was curious about the colors. I think there were like 4 colors you were using on this particular book.
I think there are six colors, and the honestly, it's just because that six colors come in that pack of tabs. People always ask, oh, my goodness, and it's color-coded, and I wish that I were that organized. I do have a system for where the tabs appear on the page. Like, if they're up in the corner, that means I definitely want to get back to that page. If I've double-tabbed something, I definitely want to get back to it, but the colors are just – they just look pretty.
Better than just all black and white.
Right.
You know, all blend together. How do you structure your interviews and such? Is it like directed conversation where you're talking with someone? Or do you have a point of lining your questions up to lead to a certain...
I have a plan. I always want to stay open to the possibility that something else might present itself. I never want to be inflexible because sometimes something really... If a guest says something that is really astonishing or that I wasn't expecting or that requires some following up, I want to have the leeway to go there. But I'm also aware that, you know, I go into these conversations well prepared and having looked at material, and my audience is, listen, they're driving their kids to school and they're at the grocery store and they're running an errand on their way to, you know, a work meeting. They're not able to pay as close attention, and they haven't sat there for hours and prepared. So the beginning part of every interview is really kind of an establishment point where I want to set up what it is we're talking about with some questions that just get everybody on the same page. You know, I don't think of myself as a teacher because it's not me who is presenting this material, but the best teachers are the ones who meet you where you are, and I want to be able to connect you with my guest by getting you ready to really listen to the most exciting things that they have to say.
One of the things that a lot of the people you've interviewed over time have talked about, and articles written about you as well, is just your ability to listen. I was wondering, is that a natural skill for you? Is that something acquired? And is it becoming less practiced than it should be?
That's a really good question. I think listening requires a certain amount of humility that we are not encouraged to practice these days. We are given devices that make us think. I mean, we're all the star of our own movie, right? But we are given devices that instantly serve us the information we want. And it's everything is tailored to our personal way of doing things and our preferences. And, you know, you go on your computer and there's a setting so that it's instantly the way that you want your desktop to look. And if someone else in the household does it, they can have their own desktop. We are not encouraged to think about other people very much. And listening requires us to realize that we may not know everything, or we may not even know as much as we think we do, or even if we know that much, that somebody else might have some valuable insight. Listening doesn't require you to change your mind if you don't want to. And in fact, I think very often we don't change our minds when we listen to people, but we respect their humanity, and we open ourselves to actually learning something if we listen. I think it's a skill that you can practice. I think about conversations with my husband, and sometimes, especially if we're disagreeing about something, what I'm really doing is waiting for him to stop talking so I can tell him what I think. And I think we all do that, right? Sitting down with somebody, there's no greater way to honor someone than sitting down with them and saying, I actually want to hear what you have to say, and I'll wait till you're finished. And when I sit down with a guest, I think they can feel that. And I feel that for me right now, that you're listening to what I have to say, and it feels like a great gift. And it's an easy gift to give if you are willing to open yourself up to it.
I was wondering, is radio a medium that shows that more than other media? Because in video, it's the image. And so, she's listening, she's static, she's not doing anything. Print, you never see that. You sort of get a sense of what someone... But listening to somebody pause and wait for an answer and how they react to that, you're sort of modeling what a good listener would do.
Radio is very intimate in I think wonderful ways. It is typically a one-on-one medium because even if you're talking to multiple people in a conversation, if you let them talk all at once on radio, it just turns into this muddy mess that no one can understand. And so people have to wait their turn. And I'm so glad that you picked up on the listening for a pause or waiting for things. I love the sound of the human voice, and I love sometimes I've had guests that I love just because of the way they use the English language or the lilt in their voice that had, you know, nothing to do with the content that they came on to talk about. And radio feels close, and it feels a little bit like being inside the head of the person that you're listening to. And there's nothing else to distract you, at least in that conversation, from what someone is trying to say. And our show is very stripped down. We don't use a lot of sound effects, and we don't use a lot of – we do have some sound elements occasionally, but we don't do that just for its own sake. Because just having a conversation can be a really interesting thing, and we've forgotten how much we can gain from just paying attention.
I was wondering if sometimes the emotion of the people you talk to, is that a hard thing to maybe get into? Say somebody is angry or they're speaking from a very deep emotional place. Is that hard for an interviewer to sort of to keep a distance at that time? Just because in listening to the human voice, we are hardwired to react in certain mm-hmm. ways, just as in when we're working in video, the human face yeah. is something we're hardwired to react to and such. Is that an issue for you sometimes when you're dealing with an emotional subject that you don't want to get sucked into where the person, or is that exactly where you want to be?
I suppose you need a little bit of distance because, you know, we're doing this show live. So I need to, no matter what we're talking about, I need to know how many minutes I have till the break. And I need to know that there are three callers here. And I need to know that somebody wants to comment on Twitter. So I'm sort of paying attention to a lot of things, which by its nature creates a bit of distance. But I think the connection is actually important. I think I'm a human being, and I never want the show to be about my emotions, but if I have a response to something and you know, my eyes mist up, it doesn't happen all that often, but that's how you talk to people. Sometimes you're talking to a stranger, you know, who sits down in the seat next to you on an airplane, and they tell you a story that moves you or touches you. And maybe you cry a little bit, or maybe you say, that's remarkable. Or maybe you say, well, I am offended by that. I think a human reaction is normal, and we're not, you know, as more and more jobs are taken over by artificial intelligence, I think the jobs that allow us to use all of our humanity, including the emotional parts of ourselves, are going to continue to be valuable to people.
Well, I think of some of the special programs that you have done, such as the day after the police shooting in Dallas and such, and, you know, the time after Charlottesville, where you've had some very controversial, very emotional events that you're interacting with either callers or the people you're talking to. And as you say, maybe that is part of the story. People are reacting from places deep within, and that's communicated in their voice. Is part of do you have a luxury of time with the program that you do, working in 1 hour and 2 hour segments? That
absolutely. A lot of what is happening in broadcasting now, and also in the sort of web space of podcasts and things like that, a lot is going very quickly, and people want to chop things up and make it very efficient to get a lot of information into a short amount of time, and they want to give you 15 flavors instead of just one. I give you one flavor, but I want to give you time to really taste it. So if you think about it like an ice cream cone, if you get 15 little spoonfuls of ice cream, you might enjoy them all and really like the variety, but you won't have time to get to the depth of something or notice that, you know, I think there's a little bit of coriander in this one or whatever. An hour is a luxury in the world today. But I think it's something that people really have a hunger for. I think people who are lifelong learners and are very curious people have the capacity to maintain interest in something for an hour. Now, if they're not interested, that I've made a mistake as an interviewer and I haven't done my job right. But plenty of people still have the attention span to interact with content for that amount of time and have the tolerance for nuance and the interest in things that may not be black and white and the willingness to consider that there are lots of different ways to look at something. So an hour is unusual in the world of media today to focus on one subject, but I can't really imagine having to work with less time on topics that are as deep and multi-layered as the ones that we try to take on the show.
The podcast you do from Think is a very popular one. There's, what, 200,000 downloads a month, maybe?
I'm not keeping track of the numbers, but that I will take your word for it.
We'll say it's big.
Okay.
But I wonder, does that open you to an audience, the ability to listen to a podcast in your own time? Does that open you to an audience that you might not have just from those who are able to catch you for an hour in an afternoon, stuck in traffic, at home, that sort of thing?
Sure. I mean, I think so many people want content on demand now, and that's the way most of us use media. You know, you and I grew up in a time where you had to be at home, you know, on Thursday night at 8 o'clock if you wanted to watch this particular show, and almost nobody exists that way anymore because we've got a lot going on. So the podcast does allow people to connect on their own time. It also allows people to pick and choose. So someone who's very interested in, you know, social justice work taking place in Liberia may not be as interested when we have a conversation about energy policy or water rights or arts or whatever. So people are able to choose what they want to listen to. And the reality is that a lot of young people don't have terrestrial radios anymore. Maybe they have one in the car. I know that I've got four teenagers, two in college and two in high school. And when I got them clock radios, they sort of looked at me like, what is this thing for? And aside from telling me what time it is, why would I want this? And why do I want a clock? Because I can look on my phone.
I've had that experience too.
Yeah.
Either that or you know, what music are you listening to? Well, it's on YouTube, Dad.
Right, exactly. And YouTube gives them, they can just choose what they want, and they don't have that collective experience that I think older folks, you know, Gen X and baby boomers grew up expecting. And there are pros and cons to our loss of shared collective experience, I think.
How do you get a sense of who your audience is?
That's a good question. We take calls to the show and we listen and we hear from people who write to us via email and on Twitter. But I like to think about the audience in pretty general terms. I don't want to ask things because I imagine that people who are very conservative are listening or people who are very progressive are listening or people who are over 40 or under 30 or whatever. I want to sort of honor the different kinds of people in my life and think about how they would hear the show. So when I'm doing an interview, I'll think, what would my mom think about what I've just asked? And would that be clear to her, a person who's, you know, 73 years old? Or I'll think, what would my next door neighbor who's really passionate about this issue think about that? And I try to work that in. I mostly try not to assume that I can get everything right for everybody, you know, because my life experience is limited. And as much as I try to educate myself, you know, I'm a white woman. I'm 47 years old. I grew up middle class. And I have educated myself or tried to about a lot of different ways of being. But I don't presume that I can ask the right questions necessarily for people whose life experiences have been very different. What I do try to do is note and honor the fact that those differences exist and keep the show open to a lot of different kinds of voices.
You used to do a version of this at night, conversations, mm-hmm. I believe. Can you tell a change in audience from daytime to nighttime? And then when you expanded, when Think expanded to statewide, where you're now in, I think, almost all of the major urban markets, maybe El Paso, I'm not quite sure, mm-hmm. but including Waco. Could you tell a difference in your audience at that point, expanding it, or were you just finding similar listeners in new pockets of the country?
That's a good question. I think I've been delighted to learn that there are think like people all over Texas, people who are curious and want to learn, and people who are willing to do a sort of grab bag show where you're never quite sure what the topic is going to be until you sit down with it. And I think those people exist in lots of different places. I think we're all shaped by the places that we live, and that's really important. And local community is really important. But I think we are also a certain kind of person is united with other people who are learners, and those people might have different skin color and a different religion and different amounts of education. But people who are learners, they exist everywhere, and they have an interest in feeding that. It becomes pretty insatiable. If you're someone who really wants to learn, you're going to find the other learners where you are, and you're going to seek out things that feed that hunger.
Good college education there continues as an adult.
Absolutely.
I was wondering, can you tell an effect as more and more people use social media, as more and more people text as a major form of communication? Can you detect that sort of thing in your audience, in that you have a long-form conversation with people? As more and more of us are on social media, it doesn't really reward those long forms. You know, you're looking at different topics, you know, one after the other. And conversation tends to be sentence at a time, two sentences at a time, or a little video image at a time and such. Can you detect that in the feedback you get from audiences? Or is that one reason your program is popular? More people want that time spent in a subject with a person, but they don't get that opportunity as much.
Those are really interesting questions to raise. Yes, I think our exposure to social media and constant media has changed us. I mean, so you've been in the newspaper business for 30-some years. You've probably always been surrounded by people who were news junkies, but it's only in the past decade or so that news junkies include your letter carrier and the butcher at the grocery store and your accountant and, you know, people who just couldn't stop and feel like they always have to have their device with them so that they're not missing a headline. I think it's making us a little neurotic. Not the consumption of information, which I still think is important, and we need to be well informed. But this idea that we have to keep up with changes, and that causes particularly the broadcast and now online media sources to always have something new so that you go to their place to find this new information. And we're really getting spun up about things that maybe if we gave them a little time, wouldn't feel so alarming or wouldn't feel so insoluble or wouldn't feel so filled with conflict. But we are encouraged to have a reaction, to vocalize that reaction or write that reaction online, and then to move on and to just tear down anybody who disagrees with us. And it doesn't really work that way. If you think about any of the successful relationships in your life, they don't work that way. You have to have the same conversations multiple times with people that you care about. I mean, a lot of married couples, you know, will have the same three arguments for the duration of a long and happy marriage. And you learn to live with people who aren't exactly like you. In real life, we know this happens, right? We know that you don't have to be aligned on everything in order to recognize that someone's important. And I always think about families, and most families in America now have some political stratification. And most families are not torn apart by this because you know that you love Aunt Janet and Uncle Waldo regardless of the fact that they voted for someone that you find abhorrent. And you remember that they took you, on their boat when you were a kid. Or you remember that they were always there if you wanted to go roller skating, that kind of thing. We have things in common. We just ignore them these days with people that we think are different than we are. And I think we're losing out on a lot of really important connections and relationships because of that.
When a lot of times the media we consume have filters that we're not aware of, or we don't choose to be aware of.
Yes, and they feed us only people they think are like us. So on my Facebook account is just a private account. The show has a Facebook account, but I have one that, you know, I use to communicate with high school girlfriends and, you know, family. But I still don't comment on politics because I think of myself, the show adheres to journalistic standards, and I like to remain neutral in my public communications. So Facebook assumes that I don't care about politics, so I don't get people ranting and raving on either side of things. My husband is very engaged and very interested in having these conversations, and all Facebook feeds him is, you know, things from people who think about the world like he does, and also things from people who are really different. And he tries really respectfully to engage with people, but usually it turns ugly, you know, and they say, how dare you, and what do you know? And he finds social media sometimes a pretty stressful thing. Like, there, you know, there's somebody had a grandchild picture here and a kitten picture here, and then 9 pages of angry political rants. And I have to say, I don't feel like I'm missing anything by not engaging in that. But it does bother me that that's all served up to us by this company that we have entrusted with a lot of our personal information to assume it knows what we want. The idea that Facebook thinks that maybe I'm not that well informed and I don't really care about current events is obviously wrong, but their algorithms have determined that that's how it goes.
Do you think about the world your kids are growing into, and how are they equipped for that's the sort of challenges they're going to face? Seeing as what you've come through in yours and just the diverse world and knowledge that you have in your experience.
I do think about the world they're moving into, and I'm very excited for their generation to take things on. So I have older teenagers. My youngest is 16 and my eldest is 19. And my 2 eldest children were eligible to vote for the first time ever. They early voted now. And I'm really excited about that. I'm excited that they want to pay attention and that they think it's important. And I do worry. I worry about the health of the planet that we're leaving to them, and I worry about their digital dependence. You know, you and I had childhoods pretty much free of anybody watching us and recording everything we did. I'm really glad the internet was not around when I went through puberty or was in high school or college. And I think kids now are sort of building a personal brand from a very young age, and there are probably benefits to that. They're thinking about their future. And I think there are probably also downsides to not being able to try on new identities without anyone remembering what you were before.
The fun part of being an adult and a parent is watching the next generation carry on.
It is fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been fascinating to talk and listen to you.
My pleasure. Thanks for your great questions.
You've been listening to a special episode of our Central Texas Leadership Series, an exclusive interview with Chris Boyd, host and managing editor for the midday talk show Think, who visited Waco for KWBU President Circle and Cornerstone Society events. Hosting the conversation was Carl Hoover, entertainment editor for the Waco Tribune Herald. This program was recorded October 26, 2018, in the KWBU studio.